Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Couple notes before we dive into today's episode. Sagar and I just recorded our latest weekend episode. We cover a bunch of great topics, Biden's State of the Union address, our latest World War II and FDR reading, spatial computing, and we respond to subscriber Q&A. To subscribe, access the full episode, and submit your own questions, go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link in the show notes. The Supercast is one of the main ways we fund the show, so if you ever particularly enjoy a conversation or a piece of content, we'd love your support. Number two, now that you've heard the Supercast pitch, it's also the perfect time to announce that today's episode will feature the Realignment's first ever ad halfway through the conversation. For the rest of the month, you'll hear about the A16Z podcast's new series on American dynamism, recorded in Washington, D.C. during their American Dynamism Summit. I've really enjoyed having Catherine Boyle, the general partner who came up with the American Dynamism term, on the show, so I cannot recommend this new series enough. You can find a link to the A16Z podcast in our episode's show notes as well. Speaking of Supercast subscribers, as promised, the Supercast version of today's episode is ad-free. So after you've checked out the podcast, you can go subscribe at realignment.supercast.com to get an ad-free experience moving forward. Now, onto the actual episode. My guest today is Frank McCourt Jr. Frank is executive chairman of McCourt Global. He's a philanthropist, and he is the founder and executive chairman of Project Liberty, an effort to remake the internet's architecture around an open protocol called the Decentralized Social Networking Protocol, which would shift the internet away from its centralized model, built and really centered around big tech companies, towards a decentralized one focused on users. Frank is a really interesting guest. He has a lot of deep thoughts on this issue. He's had an interesting career coming from a family that's been very focused on infrastructure, and he actually used to own the LA Dodgers back in the past. So he's exactly the sort of interesting guest who I love to talk with on the show. He is the author of a new book, Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, which we discuss in this conversation. A huge thank you, of course, to our original sponsor, the Foundation for American Innovation, for supporting the work of this podcast. Frank McCourt, welcome to The Realignment.
Hi, Marshall. How are you today?
Very good, and really pumped and excited to chat with you. We're releasing this a day of publication, so it's glad and great that I had some time to think about the book and the work you're doing. So here's where I'd like to begin by way of introduction to you and your work. The instant thing I saw in your press materials that made this an automatic booking for me was your description of yourself as a fifth generation builder. I'm obsessed with the conception of the builder. And if we're looking at our country right now, not just in the category of tech and the internet that we're focusing on today, but I think if we look broadly speaking, the builder mentality is going to be really key to approaching all of our challenges over the next decade or so. So I'd love you to just introduce yourself in the context of your being a fifth generation builder who thinks about the world through that framework.
Yeah, I really appreciate you kind of honing in on that, because I do think it's what the country needs right now, right? This is the country that's been incredibly creative and innovative and built some, you know, amazing things, some somewhat abstract like democracy, some very, you know, physical like our physical infrastructure. And we'll talk, I'm sure, about our digital infrastructure very soon. But yeah, I'm super lucky because I was born into a family of builders. You know, my great-great-grandfather started building roads when Henry Ford started building cars, and the family has been, you know, building ever since. And we're quite proud of it, because it's not easy to you know, have a business continue and over such a long span. And, you know, we're over 130 years old now. And I think that's precious, quite frankly. And the embedded institutional knowledge we have about how things work and how to build them, and the different generations of building we've had, not just generations of people, but generations of technology, generations of infrastructure, how we've seen things evolve over time, including the internet, I think is very apropos. And we're at a moment, I think, in the country where, you know, the technology that we use and is so, you know, omnipresent in our lives has the potential of actually really advancing us here in the U.S. and also the world, at least in democratic countries, I think just massively and just huge advances. Or if we don't address the problems with the design of the infrastructure, I fear that we'll actually lose a lot of the things we love and care about and have been so carefully built up over the last several hundred years. So I think we are at an inflection point.
Quick, fun note. I'm reading a book on American generals between World War I and World War II. And there's a section on then, Major Colonel Eisenhower. After World War I, he spent a decent portion of his time by driving across the country, testing out the new road system. He had a whole caravan that was traveling. And there was a mention of a McCourt in terms of the roads and infrastructure. And I was just thinking to myself, like, oh, like the funny coincidence, if it was the McCourt I was going to interview this week, and it clearly was. So I think that's just a fun side note there. So let's actually start there, focusing on the infrastructure question. You're obviously focused on digital infrastructure when it comes to the internet and the way it's actually set up. Can you really introduce the audience to this idea that we obviously have physical infrastructure in the real world, bridges, roads, et cetera, but there's an actual like digital infrastructure that undergirds our entire digital lives there?
Let's think about it this way, that the internet started as a communications system, right? A telecommunications device. And it came out of the Cold War era, when our government was very concerned about the centralized communication systems and apparatus that we had at that time. AT&T was the big monopoly, and our telecommunications worked through these large centralized hubs. That's how the communication was sort of switched and moved, so you could talk to someone else. And these centralized hubs were vulnerable, theoretically, to an attack by the Soviet Union, where they would destroy a hub and thereby disable our communications. So the government said, we want to have a decentralized communication system, more of a spiderweb system rather than a single line from end to end, so that if there's a damage done to a part of that spiderweb, the rest of it will still work and we'll be able to communicate and we won't be disabled. So that was the work that was done in the reasons for it pre the internet. And then in 1989, there was an agreement among researchers at four universities that were doing this work, that they would adopt a protocol, actually two protocols, TCP and IP. We've conflated them to TCP/IP, Transfer Control Protocol / Internet Protocol, that connected devices. So any device connected to using that protocol could communicate with the other device. And so now we had a decentralized communication system, which was anybody connected to the internet could, use the protocol or adopt the protocol and be connected. So that was a internet of connected devices. It was basically an internet built to connect machines. And ironically, or maybe it's not so ironic, but it's worth a footnoting, that even to this day, we are still an IP address on the internet. We're not a person. It's our device that's on the internet, not us as a person. Okay, so now let's roll the clock forward. 1989, Tim Berners-Lee, HTTP is another thin layer protocol, hypertext transfer protocol. And now, lo and behold, all the data is connected. So we have HTTP on top of TCP/IP, the devices are connected, and now the data is connected as well. And we also, by the way, a decentralized protocol designed to connect us all, allow us to share data, share information, share knowledge, and really create a rising tide that lifts all boats, make knowledge accessible and give people real opportunity. And then something happened along the way, and that was the the emergence of apps, right? These big apps, which we now use, you know, Facebook and Google and Amazon and so forth. And suddenly this beautiful decentralized technology became a highly centralized, autocratic, surveillance-based type technology where these big platforms scrape our data and aggregate it and optimize it for their own reasons. Now, underneath all of this is the telecommunication systems. You know, we all hear of 2G, 5G, all of this telecommunications apparatus, fiber optics and Wi-Fi and so forth. It's below, think of it as almost out of sight, out of mind, but it is the wiring that makes all this possible. And it's vast, sophisticated technology that has emerged over the last three or four decades to really deliver high-speed internet access to billions of people. And that's where we are today. And that's how it all works. So this is hard infrastructure and then more ethereal infrastructure, right? Because it's hard infrastructure. And then as our data moves around and our social graphs move around, they're not visible to us. So in people's minds, they're a bit abstract. And I would urge all of your listeners not to think of it as data, but rather think about it as their personhood in the digital age, because everything we do in the digital age, virtually everything we do, is digitized, is captured, and that information is stored somewhere and is, quote, owned by somebody. And of course, we would argue it should be owned by the individuals that create it.
So to understand something then, you're placing the critique of how you think the internet is broken in the terms of data scraping, privacy issues. Think of your most straightforward critiques of Facebook, Meta, et cetera, during the 2010s and early 2020s. What is the tie between those critiques of a user's experience on the internet and this already existing infrastructure that you think needs to be upgraded, aka how does Facebook's data scraping ability, what does that have to do with the process from 1989?
It was a very important shift that I think was unanticipated and driven ultimately by the economic model that was adopted. This decentralized, owned by everybody technology became highly centralized and owned by a few. And what happened, Marshall, is that the World Wide Web, which was focused on linking up data, really evolved into this internet where the network effect, which is the power embedded in the internet and where the value is derived, both economic value and also potentially common good value, right? Solving, you know, curing diseases and solving other problems at scale. What's technically called our social graph, which is our online being, everything about us, right? That's captured by one platform or the other, and then mapped. So these big platforms have a incredibly intricate map of humanity, of society. And they know everything we do, everyone we talk to, what we think. And now it's into a probabilistic or predictive phase where these algorithms are predicting what we'll do based on that makeup and so forth. So what became kind of the holy grail, the real value in the internet, was our personal data, right? Our social graphs. We shouldn't be thinking about that as data. That's us. That's our lived experience. I like to think of it as, you know, you're born with a biological DNA, and then your life is captured digitally, and that's your digital DNA. That's your lived experience. There's no more separation, though, between the two. Now it's in this world, in this digital era, they're one and the same. And even our our biological DNA is digitized now. So think of it as again, it's your person. It's who you are in the digital age. And so I ask you, should you own you or should Facebook own you? Should you own you or should Google own you? Should you own you or should Amazon own you? And I argue that, of course, we should own us. This is our data. We created it. It's about us in very intimate details about us, by the way, as well as just like what we buy or what we, you know, what movies we like or whatever. So it's everything about us that is scraped, aggregated, and then we are targeted by these platforms and to do things or to act out in a certain way or to buy something or to read something or whatever the case may be. It's upside down. We need an intranet where each of us own and control our data. Agency is returned to us. And then we, the apps of the future should be clicking on our terms of use for our data, not our clicking on these big platforms, you know, the cookies these big platforms put before us that we click on if we want to have access to the platform. You know, free access to the platform. And of course, it's not free. It's at a great cost. Our data is extremely valuable, or these companies wouldn't be worth trillions and trillions of dollars. So we now know the data is hugely valuable. Let's reclaim it. Let's reclaim the internet, reclaim our data so that we, A, have control and agency, which I think is fundamental to a democratic way of thinking and operating. And also, let's share the benefit economically of all this data, because we're creating it. Why aren't we sharing in the value that it creates?
Okay, so this is where this gets really interesting, because we're talking about, and you're mentioning words like own. I would add the word autonomy to me being a relevant way of thinking about this, because part of the issue, though, is I understand it, and pushback if you disagree. The pushback that I found compelling by basically pro tech platforms folks is they said, like, look, your individual data, Marshall Kozloff, it may seem impressive that Instagram will see that you search something on Google and all of a sudden I'm getting served ads for shoes, but my individual Marshall Kozloff specific data actually isn't worth anything when it's not aggregated with the collective whole of everyone else's data on the platform. So it's not as if, like, and this is where the whole, like, is data the new oil thing sort of breaks down, because once again, like, an individual bit of oil actually has value. My data by itself might not have value. How do you think about that critique when we're coming to this, like, you could own something here?
Yeah. So yeah, let's unpack that, because there's two or three things that are important. Number one, I use the word own a little bit loosely, because a social graph is a mapping of our activity on the internet and who we interact with. So we don't own the other nodes in that graph, we own our nodes, right? So, mm-hmm. And the value is in the interaction and the relationships and so forth. So, I think own is an okay word. I think control is a really important word. I think autonomy is a really important word. I think agency is a really important word. But I add own because there is an economic value to this that people should be able to receive some of that value if their data along with others is put to a commercial use. So it's more than just control. It's actually benefit, right? So the own is sort of shorthand for that concept. It's true that our data aggregated is more valuable than our data on its own, but it's a bit like voting, right? Mm-hmm. Does your vote matter, or does your vote only matter aggregated? We would, I think, agree that everyone's vote matters, and it's the aggregation, right, that delivers the result. So think about it kind of in those terms. Your data is more valuable, I think, than the big tech platforms would have you believe. However, there is no argument at all that the vast, vast value creation is in the data being aggregated. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that we wouldn't want to aggregate our data in order to create value or solve you know, climate change or find a cure of a disease or stop the spread of the next novel coronavirus, of course, we're going to want to aggregate our data to do it. But it's a big difference when you aggregate your data with permission, with transparency, with autonomy, and with control versus having your data surreptitiously scraped from you, be surveilled 24/7, and then have that data used in opaque ways and have it all be in a black box, right? And then used in ways that you have no visibility into, or and you're not even aware of how that data is being moved around the world. Information about you sold to other people and used in ways. And we found that we have found this out the hard way over the last, you know, now decade. This is not a new discovery. And going back to, you know, Cambridge Analytica and so on and so forth, we saw how this is being this data is being abused, and people were shocked, right, to find out that the data was being used in ways that they were unaware of. Well, this is what's happening. So again, the concept of autonomy, of agency, of control, of ownership, that's key. It's not to say, you know, that aggregating the data isn't something that we're all going to want to do in the new internet. I would rather decide how my data gets used. And if it's commercial, share in the benefit. If it's for a common good, you can have my data. And it may be, by the way, anonymous, or it may be with you know, connected to me. But I certainly don't want with the next pandemic, I don't want to have to go to the big platforms and beg them for, you know, location data in order to stop the spread of the next novel virus. This is our data, and this is serving people, and we shouldn't have to have these intermediaries, nor do we need to anymore because of the development of technology to, you know, aggregate and optimize on our data and use it for things, some we know, most we don't.
And now a quick word about the A16C podcast. Hey, it's Marshall. In an exponential era, it's more important than ever for our country to have alignment between policymakers, founders, and funders. However, it's rare we find all of them in the same room. Luckily, the A16Z podcast from Andreessen Horowitz just dropped a brand new series on American dynamism focused on exactly this. Coined by Realignment friend and A16Z general partner Catherine Boyle, American dynamism is a movement that embodies the spirit of innovation. And this new four-part series, recorded in the heart of Washington, D.C., covers topics including intelligence in the era of AI, the nuclear renaissance, and the future of defense. Guests include the CIA's first ever chief technology officer, Nand Mulchandani, the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy, Dr. Catherine Huff, and director of the DoD's Defense Innovation Unit, Doug Beck. Not to mention the founders of ambitious companies rivaling the status quo, like microreactor company Radiant, AI pilot company Shield AI, and advanced autonomous systems company Anduril. So don't miss out. Go check out the A16Z podcast and their new series on American dynamism on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. Love where this is going, because I'm really fascinated by kind of the, not just like the theory and the philosophy here, but like the business implementation side of this. So I don't know how active you are on Twitter or YouTube, but for example, YouTube, the Realignment is going to post the video of this conversation. And as part of the YouTube creator program, I'm paid out like 70% of the advertising revenue that's generated via our conversation. On Elon Musk's Twitter, if you are a Twitter Blue subscriber, when you post things, one of the benefits you get as a Twitter Blue subscriber, if you reach a certain threshold, you are paid out a portion of the advertising dollars. Yes, I know there's controversy about like how much you're getting paid, but the point is, YouTube and Twitter Blue are premised on the idea that there's value creation, and we're going to give some of that value creation to the people generating the actual content in the first place. In your vision of the internet, if you're talking about data, the information that I'm generating of my searches and my interests and my experiences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are you proposing a world where next generation Facebook would give me payouts? How do you kind of think about how this would work? Because this is kind of an internet road not taken. It was a very discreet choice made to say that, well, actually, you're paid and that this is free. You're saying it's not free. So there's a value adjustment needs to be made there. But give us a vision how you think about that.
this all evolved in with a false pretense that somehow these services were awesome. You were getting them for free. There was no harm being done. You know, your data wasn't going to be used in ways that, you know, you weren't aware of, and so on and so forth. And we find out when the curtain's pulled back that was all not true, right? That your data was used, it was sold, it was exchanged, it's all over the place, and so forth. And then there's been more and more attention paid to this problem because we see now, oh, we're not governable anymore. Our democracy is falling apart. Oh, we can't have civil conversations anymore with our neighbors and friends and even family members. Oh, we can't tell the difference between fact and fiction on the internet anymore. And deep fakes are so good, they look as real as the real thing. Oh, we're seeing now the harms to young children and how it's really, really, really hurting a whole generation of children that are not whose literally brains haven't completely developed, and the social media is rewiring their brains and disabling them in many ways by making them more anxious, more depressed, thoughts of suicide, and sadly even suicide. So we're all seeing now the harms, and we're also seeing the value because these companies are worth trillions of dollars. I mean, the big five are worth, you know, over $10 trillion. So that's unprecedented in human history. This is not even close to anything that we've seen before. So we now know that the data is really valuable. Okay, so what are some of these platforms are taking a step to do as you suggested, which is share a little bit of that value, share some of the crumbs, right, with the people that are creating lots of value for the platforms. But there's still something fundamentally wrong here. You know, we saw Zuckerberg launch Threads, Twitter, you know, Musk fighting with Zuckerberg publicly, saying you're stealing my data. No, and then Zuckerberg saying no, it's my data, and they're going back and forth. That's the point. It should be neither of their data; it's our data. And in the future, there'll be platforms that are built that we entrust with our data to do certain things on terms that we're comfortable with. So you might launch, you know, some kind of app, some kind of use case that's hosts your podcasts, and it's really interesting to people. And by the way, in this new internet, the network effect will be available to you. You won't need YouTube or Twitter to get to people, right? Because people will be on the internet, not on an app on the internet, and specific use cases will be for specific purposes, but you'll have direct access to your audience and you'll set the terms of that. And so this is basically, and I think you've teased this out beautifully, two different sets of issues here. One is a set of human rights, right? It's the idea of being treated with dignity and respect on the internet, not losing your personhood, not losing your agency, your autonomy, your choice, and on the internet. That's a human right, right? Something that the idea of liberty and so forth. This is something that our forefathers fought hard to gain, right? You know, when they left a monarchy, right, where they had no human rights. They didn't have those. They fought to gain those. Why in the world would we give them up just to use the internet? It makes no sense. And then there's a second set of rights, which are property rights. You know, when my forebears came from Ireland to the US, they couldn't really own anything. And they had very, very few rights of a human nature. And they came to a place where they were respected as an equal and they could make something of their lives, including economically. And so rather than working in a field and getting a stipend of the crop to sustain themselves, and everything else went to the king, they now could build something. And as we talked earlier, my great grandfather took a risk and started building it. And here we are having this conversation. That's the American project right there. So why would we give up something that's really valuable, which is our data, in order to use the internet? So why would we give up our human rights and our property rights just to use the internet when the internet is not Meta's and Alphabet's and Amazon's? The internet is ours. It's a piece of infrastructure that was created with our taxpayer dollars in order to connect all of us and make our lives better. And what it's doing right now, and of course, there are some good things that happen with the technology. Don't misunderstand me, but we shouldn't accept some good things and a lot of bad things. We should have all good things. And anytime we spot a bad thing, correct it. And it's, I use the analogy again of infrastructure. Let's say you were putting, you know, a plumbing system underground, right, to carry water into a million homes in a city. You know, would you argue that it's a good system if 600,000 people got clean, healthy water and 400,000 people got, you know, toxic water? Of course not. You would say it's a scandal. It's a tragedy. Who's in charge of that water? Clean up the 400,000, you know, clean up the water for the 400,000 homes. Remember Flint, Michigan, right? One community had lead poison water, and we all thought that was outrageous. So why would we accept an internet now that's connecting billions of people where much of what's going on is toxic water? It's toxic information. It's not helpful to society. And we can fix that at the infrastructure level by adding yet another protocol. We call it DSNP, which would give us ownership and control of our data. That's the solution. Core level infrastructure, another protocol. Now that we know that this is a social medium, right? It's our social graphs. Let's make the internet a social internet where we're in charge of our information, which is where the value lies on the internet. And then let's also have to be a person. You know, you can be anonymous, but you can't pretend you're me, or vice, I can't pretend I'm you, or you can't be a machine bot, and so on and so forth. So let's develop an internet where the apps are interoperable, they're clicking on our terms of use, you have to be a person, you control your graph, it's portable, et cetera, et cetera. It's very doable.
So I want to set this up very specifically, and I'm glad you just closed there by pointing out the infrastructure argument, which is really leading into Project Liberty and the work you're doing there. I will just raise this in the following way to make this really discernible to people. So there are very few areas of bipartisan agreement in our society. However, I'd say that most people, decision maker or otherwise, would sign on to the statement that they're not happy with the internet status quo. What we do with that is where this gets complicated, but basically everyone would hear your list of issues and say, yeah, that's basically true. Therefore, there are a couple of different responses we could have as a society to a broken status quo. And I'd like to go through version one and version two, and then we'll get further into Project Liberty, the infrastructure one, which is version three. So version one would be, okay, so people don't like how Facebook, Meta, Twitter, et cetera, use their data. Let's launch a new company that explicitly, as part of its branding, says, hey, like, we're not going to misuse your data. We're going to think about using existing internet infrastructure in a different manner that takes advantage of this opportunity here. We've had 10 years of discourse on these problem sets. My perspective tends to be, if these alternate companies were, if there was an opportunity to launch alternate companies under the status quo, it basically would have happened by now. If we were to use that as a kind of quasi-libertarian response to, like, the critique of big tech, I'm curious, from your perspective, why has the launch an alternative to the existing big tech players approach not worked, quote unquote?
Yeah, and by the way, there are use cases that take that perspective, right? There's a social media platform by the name of MeWe, which has 20 million users, who, by the way, are migrating over to DSNP right as we speak. But they hit a ceiling because they're not buying in to the. By the way, they're a great candidate for DSNP because they're not scraping people's data, and they are very, they have a data bill of rights for people, but they haven't been able to get the scale because they don't have the network effect. 20 million can't compete against 3 billion. DuckDuckGo in search is another example of a use case that doesn't target you and, you know, scrape your data and surveil you and so on and so forth. Again, struggling to get the scale because they don't have the network effect. So we have a current model which favors these privileged entities that have accumulated all of this data about us and about everyone, and they are the holders, unique monopolistic holders of this huge trove of social graph data. And it's hard for someone to come forward and compete against that in the current model. We have to change the model and make that version obsolete. So that's why it hasn't happened. And by the way, just to repeat the point, imagine an internet where the data, this vast amount of human data, is part of the internet itself. The data is not sitting in server farms at Alphabet or Meta or Amazon or Microsoft or Apple. It is part of the internet. So we have a global social graph that's universally accessible. And anyone who builds something that people are, you know, interested in could benefit from that network effect. But the difference is with permission. You know, you would have to give your permission to have your data used by this new awesome app that's built. So think of this new internet not as one that replicates the current version, where you'll end up having five new giants, right? But rather thousands, millions of apps that interoperate, and think of it as a killer ecosystem, not as a killer app. Because if the information can move from one app to the other under your control, then you can have all kinds of apps that specialize in different things that are really interesting and fun and useful. And if one is just making stuff up and everybody knows it, then people can, you know, can stop using it, or they can view it as entertainment, but not confuse it with a fact-based use case. You know, you're too young, but I grew up in an age where, you know, there was something called the National Enquirer, and it was on the checkout lines of grocery stores.
This is unfair. I'm 32 years old. I remember the National Enquirer.
Well, nobody.
Sorry, go on.
Nobody confused when I was growing up the National Enquirer with the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, right? They understood that it was entertainment news. It was made up stuff. Well, when you start merging the National Enquirer with the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times and mash it all up, and nobody can quite tell what's fact and fiction, what do people do? They just go to their, you know, their own belief system, or what they want to believe, or what they think, and they start to pull out the facts, quote, alternative facts that they think supports their point of view, because there's no discernment or differentiation. This is a very dangerous moment, Marshall, because if we lose the ability to discern fact from fiction, if we lose truth and lose trust, then what do we have? We have chaos, and you don't have democracy without trust. And I just would remind my fellow capitalists that you don't have a market economy. The version we have now of capitalism doesn't exist without trust. So there's a lot at stake here.
Actually, let me just ask you a question as a business person, because I'm obsessed with, as a person who works in the political policy space, there are certain types of problems, and this tends to affect the space where you work, where you could articulate something as a problem at a narrative level very beautifully and in a way that people will nod their heads, but it's not quite enough to get them to actually push a button in the way that let's say in a business, oh, that's an actual problem I have as a user. I will pay money, opt in, switch, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think this new protocol you're proposing will help users transition from a point where they hear teen mental health crisis, disinformation, the lack of truth, and not just like nod and agree with the narrative, but actually at a user level say that is worth transitioning from these tech platforms or from a status quo that, you know, I first joined Facebook in 2007. You know, it's been 15 plus years. Help me translate from the narrative to the actual take an action on a business level side.
Yeah, I think you're really honing in on exactly the next challenge. What we have proven with Project Liberty is that there is a solution to this problem. And the tech works, and it works quite well, and it's scalable. So what we're now in the process of doing is working with others and many, many others, building out the new ecosystem. And the first use case, I alluded to that earlier, is a Web2 social media app by the name of MeWe, M-E-W-E, which is migrating its 20 million users over to DSMP. And, you know, we're at somewhere between 650,000 and 700,000 people have migrated over. And that's just from one app. And that's just in a matter of a few months. So imagine when there's thousands of apps. I mean, there are 9 million apps in the world today. And seven of them are consolidated into two app stores. So, you know, again, consolidation, centralization, and so forth. Imagine a world where there's millions of apps and you're not paying a 30% tax. And these, and people are migrating.
And you mean the 30% tax on the app store, correct?
The 30% tax on the 30% that you, people pay for the privilege of being in either Google or Apple's app stores. Yeah. It's not a tax that's warranted or necessary in this new internet. And again, let's have the 9 million use cases, but have them interoperable, not paying a 30% tax. And imagine everybody's going to want to be in this new world. And again, think of it as, I think of it as like, what is required for human beings to physically migrate? Right? There are two things required. One, you have to be completely fed up with where you're living or be afraid, right? Or be, it's no longer habitable for whatever reason. And that's a tough decision for people to make because people love their homes and where they're from. But at a certain point, they start thinking about, should I go somewhere else? Can I go somewhere else? But there's a second, you know, the criteria, and that is like, where am I going? If I pick my family up and leave, or if I leave my family, where am I going and why? I need a place to go. You don't just pick up and leave and wander, right? And so right now, I think the first criteria of people being understanding that the current internet is no longer habitable, I think we're getting there. I really do. I think people are seeing it. But until there's a place to go, I don't think people are leaving the current internet. And that's why we need to create this alternative. And what Project Liberty is doing is coming forward with a solution, not with all the answers, but with a key component of the solution, which is, hey, if we fix this at the protocol level, and this is an internet not about devices and not about data, but an internet that's about people, and we put people first, and of course, use the connected devices and the ability to capture data as features of this new internet. But it's our social graph that turns out to be the value. It's the connection, human connections that turns out to create the network effect. Data is inanimate. Data just is data, but human beings and their activities and relationships and preferences and behaviors, that's dynamic. And that's what's made the internet so powerful. And so let's acknowledge that. We now have seen how it's operated for the last 20 years. And let's actually put people back in charge of the internet and of their their relationships and their social graph generally is used. And then, you know, then we're off to the races. Then we can really see that this internet will help us solve lots of problems. And as we enter this next phase of generative AI, which, by the way, is the same technology, just a more powerful version, the same architecture, right? It's aggregating data and applying probabilistic algorithms to it, you know, predictive algorithms, which is exactly what's happening now, but with generative AI, these are huge data sets that are trained to operate in a certain way, and it's huge compute power. And just, Marshall, quick question. Yeah. Who has the huge data sets and the huge compute power?
I mean, right now it's the platforms.
It's the same few. That's right. And they're the only ones that are going to benefit from generative AI and under the current model, which is why you see them, you know, just so interested in showing up in Washington and meeting with policymakers and elected officials to get regulations that will protect them. And by the way, make it more difficult for others to get in the space. And I would say we're at a moment right now where we need to level the playing field, return ownership and control of data to people. Maybe some people don't care about their data and the value or it's how it's used, and they'll keep giving it to Facebook. That's their choice. That's their prerogative. But I believe many people will actually look around and say, you know what? I can get everything that Facebook gives me from this new app that is, that's compensating me and not using my data in ways that I don't agree to, and so on and so forth. And the key is, lots of us have to move over and do that, right? And, you know, 650,000 or 700,000 in a few months makes, you know, this project the largest decentralized social networking project in the world. But we need 10 million, then 100 million, then a billion, and so forth. And then there's an alternative. I think once you have 10 million people in this new ecosystem, you've got a real thing that's an alternative, because that's scale. And then suddenly you'll see more and more people moving over more and more rapidly. I think this is going to happen quickly, because unlike, you know, when my forebears came from Ireland to the US and had to be on a boat for a month and, you know, fight, you know, disease and they didn't call them, you know, coffin ships for nothing, right? And it's a heck of a lot easier to switch to, you know, from one generation of the internet to the next by adopting protocol than it is to be on a ship and to leave your family, et cetera, for, and head across the ocean, not knowing quite what's on the other side.
You know, two things I want to say, because I want to make these both very clear. What I find so fascinating about the approach y'all have taken at Project Liberty is you're looking at the structure of the internet and how it produces the status quo. So rather than just coming to me or anyone with your book of, hey, like, here's this new company that is going to change the game here, you're actually saying, we're going to look at what's producing this status quo that no one really likes and focus on the infrastructure side of it. So your value add here isn't convincing me that you have this brilliant social media app or this decentralized Uber that I need to get excited about. I've had those conversations before, but your point is, the actual hinge point here is, let's introduce a new infrastructure layer that will then produce new behaviors, new social media and entree points, different actual issues there. I think the structural focus is just really, really smart and very, very, very well taken. I think the, you know, second is, we're, you know, to last questions, we're nearing the end here. I would be very curious to unpack something you wrote in the book, which is you mentioned a skepticism of the regulatory approach to a lot of these questions. And this is also an interesting case where we've had 10 years of debate around regulating the internet broadly. Obviously, you've had certain areas where the Overton window has shifted. So for example, you're seeing a lot of energy towards social media bans for those under 18. Who knows if that's actually gonna be implemented, but that's a clear area where there's been a lot of energy picked up, especially tied to the teen suicide level issues. How do you really differentiate the regulatory approach from the approach you are taking at Project Liberty? Because I could see a person who's half listening to this episode and think that what you're proposing here is that Congress passes a bill that mandates this new infrastructure law. That's clearly not what you're doing, but can you just make it very clear for people, kind of like the point you're taking in contrast to the regulatory approach?
Yeah, so let me give you a very concrete example. So in the early 90s, in 1993, my family started a telecom company by the name of RCN. And at the time, there were also oligarchs. There were seven telecom oligarchs. They were the Baby Bells. And that was after the breakup of AT&T. And, you know, we had an idea, which was to give people the high-speed internet access, and many weren't even sure what that meant at the time, because 93, you know, remember, the World Wide Web is 89, and 93, it's still very nascent. But high-speed internet access, cable TV, and their phone service from one provider. It was called bundling at the time. RCN was the first ever. And it was interesting. People were, and by the way, our thesis was the oligarchs are all living on top of copper wire and, you know, ancient switching devices and so forth. And the internet is a high-speed broadband type of technology. So you want fiber optic cable and so on and so forth. It's easier to build that from scratch than it is to convert a copper system to a fiber optic system. So we thought we had a huge advantage by going into cities where most of the customer traffic was and build this out. So off we went. And what was interesting was that the biggest friction point in terms of people signing up for RCN was not being able to have their phone number. In other words, they would sign a contract and then they'd say, and here's my phone number. And we would have to say, sorry, we can't give you your phone number because the all of, you know, the baby bells, they say they own you. They own your phone number. And then, you know, and people said, well, that doesn't feel right. It's my number. It's, you know, my wife knows my number, my girlfriend, my parents, my, you know, grandparents, my kids, my friends. It's me. It's mine. And thankfully, the U.S. Congress agreed to that in 1996 as part of the Telecom Act. Phone numbers became portable, and our company and other similar efforts became, you know, got traction and so it became big companies. And suddenly, the world, the consumer world, benefited from more competition, right? Because now RCN shows up and gives you high-speed internet access. What are you going to do, baby bell? Are you going to give, you know, a customer a high-speed internet access or not? Who was going to give the best price? Who was going to give a free phone? Who had a stronger signal? You had competition and phone number portability. You now could use any carrier you want and move your phone number around. And the oligarchs, the seven baby bells, had to figure out also how to be interoperable, right? Because they didn't want to lose the business. So suddenly, you know, your phone number worked. If you could be on AT&T and I could be on Verizon and somebody else on T-Mobile and our phone number worked, right? Well, it wasn't like that in 1993 or 4 or 5. It wasn't like that until 96. And it seems to anybody probably under 40, and you fit into that category, that kind of dumb that our phone number wouldn't work, you know, across different carriers. And you mean if I moved from New York to LA, I needed to get a new phone? And new phone number. Well, yeah, that was the world then. Well, I'm glad we have the world we have now, right? Where you don't need a new phone, your number works, including if wherever you travel around the world. I tell you that story for two reasons. Number one, we proved that it worked and then asked for a regulation that would help level the playing field for everyone. There are two types of regulations. One is the kind most people talk about, which is antitrust and constraint and control and so forth. But there's another one which is equally important, which is, you know, leveling a playing field, removing friction so that innovation can occur. And I think that's the type of regulation that's going to help us moving forward. But the regulation to get these big companies to do the right thing is just, our regulators are overmatched. The technology is too powerful. They're taking lots of money, our elected officials, from these platforms, right, to get elected. And sadly, they're using the platforms to raise money and get elected, right? They're using social media to very extreme ways. And that's why the extreme voices are the ones we hear the most loudly. And we've all seen the congressional hearings and how, you know, it's theater, right? And then nothing happens. Well, there's a reason why nothing happens, and because these our elected officials are not truly interested in fundamentally solving this problem, because they're using the technology and these companies are providing lots of resources to these officials. And I just would argue that we need to just shine a bright light on this. And so Project Liberty is not a regulatory project or a regulation forward project. It's an innovative project. Let's innovate our way forward here. And sure, there may be some regulations that are useful to accelerate the change, but I for one don't think we're going to be able to regulate these huge entities which are omnipresent in our lives and are all over Washington, D.C. and all over any state house or the U.S. Capitol is making, you know, any kind of regulatory noise, they're all over it. And as you say, it's been decades now. This isn't like people
untested woke up hypothesis. You know, it's we've kind of run the experiment to a certain degree.
Exactly. And the harms are real. So why aren't we fixing it? And there's usually a good answer as to when something's not being fixed and it's obvious it should be, like, well, why not?
So here's the closing question. So you're a very successful guy. Like, you're engaged in a lot of different areas. You have a public policy school at Georgetown named after you. So when you frame an issue as our biggest fight, you're very concertedly putting your money where your mouth is in a way that me just sort of saying, actually, like, this topic of my hobby horse is the most important one. Like, you've really proved you think this is the central one. I just like you to really contextualize that as we close out this episode. Like, why out of all the different policy areas that you could write a book about, invest money in, start organizations, hire folks, and like, why is this literally our biggest fight and your biggest fight effectively?
It goes back to, my dining room table growing up, and being one of seven kids, and you picture nine of us plus guests, friends at the dinner table. It was pretty interesting conversations, and me and my siblings were pretty good at identifying problems, and complaining about them. But no dinner would end before my mom said, "Okay, kids, you've done a great job at identifying the problems. Now, what are you going to do about it?" Right. So this is hardwired in me, and we talked a little bit earlier about the builder infrastructure mentality as well. So I'm fortunate to kind of be wired the way I'm wired, and seeing this problem and knowing how to fix it is something I can't at this stage of the game unsee, right? Having seen it. Now let's go to more recent history. I owned the Dodgers and had the privilege of owning them from 2004 to 2012, the Los Angeles Dodgers. And unfortunately got divorced at the tail end of that, ended up selling the team because of the divorce. I was on the receiving end of social media. And I that was when, Facebook was 5+ years old, and the smartphone, Apple's iPhone was becoming ubiquitous. It had been released. And in those years of 2010, 11, it was no fun being on the receiving end of social media and being totally helpless, just unable to, you can't say that's wrong. That's wrong. That's not true. You're just on the receiving end. So I saw the technology emerging. And I'm not asking anyone to feel sorry for me. I'm doing great. My point is, I know what it feels like, and it doesn't feel good. And I know how unfair it is. And I see it happening to millions and millions of people. Now, you mentioned the public policy school. So let's roll the clock forward even a little bit more. Had the privilege of starting that school with some of the proceeds that I received from the sale of the Dodgers, and thought, perhaps naively, that, create policies that would, redirect things so that, just wholesale damage wouldn't be done to society and democracy by this technology that we had unleashed without really putting in safeguards. And realized fairly quickly that the policymakers could not keep up with the technology. It's just an unfair match. One moves slowly, the other moves quickly. One is trying to do the right thing in a very deliberate way. The other is that, quote, moving fast and breaking things, right? And so I remember a story of a faculty member sharing with me that she had a theory that you could predict in advance that a large-scale human migration was going to occur based on words that were amplified on social media. Imagine it like a bubble diagram, right? Mm-hmm. And the government was very interested in that, our government, because if she could sharpen that model, that would be a very useful tool for governments and humanitarian organizations to know if 1 million people were going to pick up from one country and move to other places. And to know that in advance would be hugely helpful. And she got a couple $100,000 to do it. She knew Twitter had the data. She went to them, asked them for the data. And they said, yep, we have the data and you can have it for $100,000. And she said, I can't give you $100,000 for that data. That's half my budget. I won't be able to do the work. I'll have the data, but won't be able to do the work. And they said, well, that's the deal. So she couldn't buy the data and she had to deal with what was publicly available. That said a lot to me. Here we have millions of people in incredibly difficult circumstances, or they wouldn't be thinking about leaving their country, right? And so the most vulnerable amongst us, they're the ones creating the data, right? They're the ones on social media creating the information. And here's a faculty member at a university, not getting paid a lot of money, having a theory as to how to use that data to actually help those people and others and just help humanity, society. And she's not doing it for commercial reasons. And then there's the data that would be available to help. And the data isn't available. It's out of reach, even though it was created by these same vulnerable people. And it's being purely monetized. And somebody's saying, we own that data. Right then and there, I knew the system was completely broken, because this data should be available to all of us to help solve problems, not only to predict human migration, but how about to prevent the need for human migration to start with? How about helping cure diseases? How about sharing the wealth? How about sharing knowledge and giving people access to this new world? At the end of the day, we're living in a digital age, and I believe that we need a movement that actually gets people to recognize that there is a better way forward. It's not what we're staring at right now in our national elections, which is kind of more of the same. And these two, this sort of rerun of what we've had, and this what I would call lack of civic imagination. Mm-hmm. We need civic imagination and use this technology to enable that and empower people en masse for us to have a better world and a better society. And I think it's quite possible. And I want to leave this conversation on that note, because there's a lot to complain about. There's a lot that's wrong. And technology is causing a lot of the harm. But it doesn't have to be this way. We can fix this. This is very fixable if we think about it as an engineering problem, as an infrastructure problem, and then build a new internet that actually puts human beings at the forefront.
Very well said. Frank, thank you for joining me on The Realignment. The book is Our Biggest Fight, and the organization is Project Liberty. Really recommend everyone take a look.
Thank you, Marshall. Take care of yourself.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.